Today's paramis are truth and determination, resolve. And these are wonderful topics, and I think of them as working together. Without a commitment to truth, there is no Buddhist path. Without a commitment to truth, there is no mindfulness. Mindfulness is the practice of telling oneself the truth, moment by moment. And this idea of truth and resolve or determination, they are the seventh and eighth step, or seventh and eighth of the list of the paramis. And if we see the paramis as progressive, that one is the foundation for the next, it's important to remember that we're quite well into them. They're a relatively mature stage of practice. And all the other ones, the first six, are the foundation for it. We're putting down a foundation that supports us. As I think probably all of you know, that Buddhism puts a tremendous amount of emphasis on impermanence, how impermanent and inconstant this life is. What's not emphasized is that we don't have to be the victims of impermanence, that we're just at sea and things change, you know, just we have to go along with it. That as things change and move, we can affect the flow, the stream of how things unfold over time, how they change. They're always changing. So if you learn to swim, and there's someone who is drowning in the river, you have now a different possibility than when you didn't learn how to swim. And a different reality, a different future unfolds, because you can go in the water and take the person in. If you cultivate your capacity for empathy, it allows for a different engagement with change. When you're sitting with a friend who is in mourning, you have a capacity to be a good friend, maybe better if you have the empathy and understanding. So we cultivate ourselves in Buddhism. We're putting together a foundation for maturity and practice. And in a particular way, we are putting down the foundation for no reason at all. And I'll explain that as we get along. And that no reason is the best reason ever. And so, you know, to cultivate our capacity for generosity and integrity, for renunciation and wisdom, for effort and patience, and then for truth, discovering the truth and being committed to the truth. And the topic of truth is, you know, a multifaceted topic. There's many angles in which to talk about it. But I want to talk about it from the point of view of probably what was some of the deepest truth that Buddhism has to offer. Maybe the deepest truth. The one for which, you know, it's well worth being committed to have an intention for, to be resolved on. So, just to go a little bit out of order, I want to first say a few words about this word determination or resolve. The Pali word is adhitana, and it's translated into English in different ways. I love the translation resolve because of its etymology. That it has the same Latin root as the word solve and the word dissolve. And so it kind of means to untie something or to loosen something or free something. So when something dissolves, it's being freed and loosened into the liquid. So this idea, because sometimes the word determination, some people think, oh, I have to be determined. I have to really, steel myself and be a samurai and really kind of get hard. But it's possible to have a tremendous commitment that is dissolving, that's somehow releasing. It's kind of like it's possible to be very diligent at staying relaxed. And if you get tense, being diligently relaxed, that doesn't work, right? So there's a wonderful art of kind of being diligent, but not, you can't get tense doing that, because that's not what you're trying to do. So to be diligent at being free, diligent at being liberated, it doesn't work then to get clamped down at freedom. There has to be a quality of release, dissolve, so that's this idea of being resolved, and many people are in fact quite resolved or quite committed to their suffering. Though, they wouldn't see it that way, most people. Or they're quite committed to their neurosis. Or they're quite committed to their delusion. Or they're quite committed to their judgments. They're quite committed to their identity, attached to it in a way that creates me and you, self and other, in a way that divides people. And we are quite committed to things maybe which are unreliable. I've known people who were committed to and dependent on having a lot of money. And there was something about that commitment, dedication, resolve on getting money that made them careless. And they lost it all. And then there was a people in Burma, a story I like to tell, when I was meditating there. I was there for 8 months. The Burmese money was not, the exchange rate was such that it was set by the government at the wrong rate. So most people would go, exchange their dollars on the black market because they got a much better rate or a more realistic rate or something like that. And a lot of people didn't trust the government or whatever, so they kept, a lot of people kept cash at home under their mattress. Lots of it. So a lot, so the whole economy ran on this kind of black market, and you could say maybe it was a little bit corrupt, be black market, but the government was worse. So who was going to have the, where the money was? So one day I woke up, and was told, and the whole country was told, that most of the paper money was no longer going to be honored, no longer had any value. And they were issuing new money to the people who had bank accounts and money in the bank. I said, what? We say in God, and God we trust. I thought that, certain things were, you could depend on, And those greenbacks, that's like, There is inflation and all that, but gee, you know, that you can, some things you can depend, you have that and you're secure and stable. I think they did some like recently like that in India too, didn't they? And just suddenly decided to. And so that's kind of interesting. So if your commitment is towards certain, you know, things that are not reliable. I've known people who have been committed to their health, committed to their recreational opportunities, committed to all kinds of things that they didn't even know they were committed to, but they realized how resolved they were on it when they somehow started to slip away, be lost maybe, and how much of their happiness, well-being was dependent on it. And so this question of what we're committed to is actually a very important topic. What are we depending on? What are we feel like it has to be? And are there some things which are more reliable than other things to be committed to be resolved on, to be determined on? And I think that Buddhism says there is. And this idea of adhitana, this resolve or determination, is actually a beautiful quality. The literal meaning of it, I don't know what in Pali is, to take a higher stand, take a stand. So really, you take a stand on something. This is important. This is where I base my life on. And what is it reliable to base your life on? In adhitana can also kind of mean like a vow. And what is it to live a life of a vow? Not exactly a promise or an obligation. In my Zen practice, there was a lot of talk about vow. And for me, it made a lot of sense to me, the vow, because when I got around to thinking about the vows we took, by that time, I recognized that it was my heart's wish. It was something that was arising out of me, that this is how I wanted to live, my heart wanted to live, that had some truth to it. And that the vow was giving expression to what the heart wanted. So it wasn't like I was taking an external vow. I was giving voice to what was already happening. And then it made a difference to make a vow publicly to other people. So this is what my life is going to be about. And so it requires, you know, this approach to vow and to determination and commitment and that's freeing, that's relaxing, that is not a burden to have, but rather is the opposite of a burden. It lightens us, inspires us to have it, is built on, in the Paramis, on the idea of truth. Powerful word, truth. The word is satya, S-A-C-C-A, and there's some scholars of ancient Indian languages who want to make the argument that the word satya also has the meaning of what's real, reality. So it's not just like a propositional truth, like, you know, that it's true you should stop at stop signs or something. That's a convention. But it's a truth of reality. It's what's real. And how can we know what's real? What is real? So, if a person is clinging, a clinging commitment, clinging really dedicated to really clinging to this, this is really important. And the thing they cling to are flying elephants. And they carry that clinging with them for years. Tight, hard, grasping onto this idea and the truth of flying elephants and Why doesn't anybody else believe it? You know, understand how important flying elephants are. You know, holding on tight. As far as I know, there are no flying elephants except in animation. And so they're clinging to something that doesn't really exist. But then one day they come to IRC and someone sits up here and says, you know, it's a good idea to let go of your clinging. And they say, oh, I'll try it. And they let go of their clinging to flying elephants, their idea, the clinging. And they, wow, I had no idea that there could be this sense of release, this freedom, this absence of clinging. I thought it was required to be a human being, to be clinging and holding on, be committed to something like this. And but actually, without that clinging, my fist is relaxed, hand is relaxed, it's open. The sensitive part of my hand, of my heart, my brain, wherever the clinging is available to feel and be in the world much more. Wow, this is good. So there was a time. So we say in Buddhism, talk about monkey mind. And some of you might occasionally have experienced monkey mind. The analogy is that that of monkeys who are swinging from branch to branch through the forest. And as soon as they've let go of one branch, they're already grabbing the next branch. And so they're just constantly clinging, grabbing, grabbing, grabbing. So as soon as we let go of one thought, we're on to the next one or next thing. It's just that the mind can operate that way sometimes. But this is a little different story. This has to do with bat mind, or you know, bats. And there was a time, once upon a time, before bats flew. But they have, at the end of their arms, they have, you know, like little hands, little fingers, and they can grab. So there was a time when bats were quite proficient at swinging from branch to branch. And as soon as they let go, immediately their whole life, their whole being is all about grabbing the next thing and holding on. Sometimes they just hang. They hang for hours, but they never wanted to let go of a branch. Or they did, they immediately grabbed the next one, next one, next one. And then one day it occurred to a bat to, you know, this, I noticed something strange. There's something odd going on here in my swinging. So what is this, that's odd thing? And they study it. They, what is it? It has to do with the hand. You know, there's a strange thing that happens. There's a split second there when I let go before I grab the next branch. That feels good. But it's really fast. That feels good. And then the bat thinks, well, what happens if I just don't grab again? So the bat lets go. Doesn't grab, and lo and behold, the wings are there, and they're soaring through the trees. And that's how they learned to fly. Once upon a time. So, are you swinging and grabbing and grabbing? What are you holding on to? And this idea that we can let go. And then something wonderful happens in letting go. The letting go is nothing. In the sense that, you know, if I have a fist and I open my hand, what happened to the fist? Where is it? There's no fist anymore. It's gone. It's nothing. Now, if I like that nothing, like the release, like that nice feeling of being open and relaxed, and I have a habit of clinging, so then I might cling to that, grab onto that. And what happens when you grab on, make a fist? You lose the open hand. But the hand disappears, the fist disappears as soon as the hand is open. It's a nothing. The fist is a nothing at that point. When we release our clinging, something has disappeared and is nothing. The clinging. The absence of clinging. But this is a hard thing to appreciate because it's nothing. We're supposed to have something. We're supposed to be something. We're supposed to get something. We're supposed to experience something. Come to IRC and spend a week, and then you go to a wonderful cocktail party afterwards, and people are like, "Where have you been?" "I've been at a meditation retreat." And what was it like? What good did it do you? "Oh, what did you get?" "Nothing." They're going to scratch their head and say, "What? I went to, you know, gala cruise around tropical islands or something, and you got nothing?" And you smile because you know that the nothing you have is pretty special. It was such a relief, such a joy, such almost sacred, or actually was sacred, to experience the heart and the mind with no contraction, no clinging, no fear, no resistance, no bracing against life, no doubt, just everything's opened, free, relaxed. So you could kind of, you know, build it up and say glorious things about it. But I kind of like that we're, you know, we don't make a big deal out of it. It's just, it's nothing. But it's, you know, but it is a kind of big deal, because that absence of clinging is the end of suffering. And what a fantastic thing that is. What a possibility, what a joy, what a relief, what a wonderful thing to no longer suffer, to discover what it's like to have, even temporarily, the end of suffering. So maybe then we fly like the bats, in our, each and every one of us in our own unique way. Who knows what wings you have, or what flows through you when you really get out of your way, and when you're free, when you allow yourself to be just who you are, with no apology and no defensiveness and no needing to assert yourself to prove yourself. You're just allowed to be. Because all the ideas of assertion and apology and all that are, you know, represent some kind of unhealthy commitment, some clinging, holding on. But if you allow just to be yourself, I like to think that this practice that we're doing is a practice that's going to allow you to completely be yourself. And that might seem ridiculous, because who else have I been all these years? Of course you've been yourself, but how many personas have you put on? How many roles? How many pretendings? How many hidings? How many games, social games, have you played to try to impress people or hide from people? Or how many attitudes have you put on that are not really true? There was once upon a time, in the land of fairy tales, there was a princess to be married, who was the monarchs of the realm had an arrangement for her to marry the prince of the neighboring realm. But the neighboring realm was the realm of trolls. And in Trollland, they had a particularly very beautiful, extremely pretty prince in the eyes of trolls. But in the eyes of this princess, the prince was horrendous. Big, bulky, large, filled with scales, fish scales over the whole skin. And if it wasn't scaly, it was full of warts and fangs of a dragon. For the princess, this was pretty horrendous. This was going to be her husband? So, not knowing what to do, she went into the woods to visit a wise person there. Someone who was so wise had figured out not to be involved in princes and princesses and he and hers, and had a whole different way of living, was free. But people were thought this was a very wise person. So the princess went to the wise person and explained her dilemma. And the wise person said, okay, I know what's needed. When you get married, when you go for your wedding day, put on 10 gowns, wedding gowns. And when you go to the bridal chambers at the end of the wedding, and it's time to take off your clothes, tell the troll, the scaly troll, that for every time you take off a gown, the troll has to take off one set of scaly skins, like a snake shedding its... So she did, they did. So she's got there and asked that of the troll, the scaly troll. And so she took off her gown and the prince took off one suit of scales. And they went down 10. And when she came to the last, took off her last gown, then the troll took off his last. And lo and behold, underneath that was beautiful human, pretty human prince. And they lived happily ever after. Except for the trolls who were confused. What happened to our prince? So, so he put on all these coats, all these scales, all this personas, all this obligations, all this shoulds, all this ideas of how we're supposed to be. And sometimes we live under a huge burden. We learn from our family, from our culture, from our religion. And there's layers and layers of this stuff that we live under. And to do this practice is to discover that it's possible to take them off. That at what we cling to, the clinging is not really... And we learn to see and recognize how we cling. And so there's a truth of seeing our attachments, seeing what we're holding on to, what we're depending on, what we're driven by, the compulsions we have, the things that we insist it has to be this way. And we see how it hurts to hold on. To hold on to our resentments is a guaranteed way to hurt ourselves. Some people hold on to the resentments because they think then they can hurt the person they're resentful for, get back or something. And there are people who eventually realize that their resentee has long forgotten even who they are. They've gone on, and there has no, you know, you're not, no value, no purpose for the resentee, the person you're resentful for, to still be resentful. You're only hurting yourself. Trying to be, you know, the good mother, the good son, the good daughter. Trying to be the right this, trying to be fit into society by being a certain professional role or certain outstanding citizen or where, you know, the coat that I've seen. I saw one person who, as I was told the other day about the wonderful coaches who volunteered their times. Remember one coach, baseball coach, who was volunteering his time, but he was really attached to being the coach of a winning team. And it was really ugly how he treated the kids when they messed up on the field. And the kids started to not play well and be uninspired and because of how the coach was treating them. I think he was a self-fulfilling prophecy, the kind of thing where he was just causing the very thing that he was trying to prevent by yelling at the kids and stuff. And luckily he didn't last very long as a little league coach. Being the one who has to be kind, or being the one who has to be smart. Being the one who doesn't cause any trouble for anyone. There's all these things we hold on to. So as we meditate, we take off the robes, the skin. I like it's either one. Sometimes it just feels like something that we already know it's not who we are. But sometimes like so intimate and skin-like what we hold on to. That actually feels like something's ripping when we can let go. That really? That too? Let go. Let go. And it's a wonderful process to go down the layers and layers and really start feeling like we're touching something beautiful and deep that's inside, something that's been buried perhaps. Or to touch it more often, something we've known was there, but you know, it's not really been part of our life very much. And to discover deep in, there it is, and to learn how to stay close to it, be here. It turns out that as far as I can tell, I haven't really done the full survey of the planet yet, but for what I can see, everyone is beautiful inside. Everyone has something really honorable and inspiring in there. And to take off the coats, take it off, take the skins off like a snake skin, and to be able to touch and see and experience things like generosity and integrity and compassion, to be able to have a wellspring, or maybe a kind of a fountainhead or a source of peace, tranquility, harmony. To have a place that where it feels like out of which there's a commitment, a natural commitment to being truthful. It's inspiring to me to meet people who have this commitment to never lie. Because if they feel, not because that they just been told you should never lie, but they really, it's kind of like grates them or kind of, they can feel the violence to themselves to lie. So that's a beautiful quality that's inside. So to take off the layers and layers, the static that gets in the way of that. And do that process. In that process, each step along the way, this is a releasing of clinging. A release. And it's a little step of experiencing nothing. Glorious. We want to give a nice kind of adjective so we get a little bit, you know, at least the people at the party don't just dismiss us. You could be, what was it like in the retreat? Oh, it was glorious nothing. It was a luminous nothing. It was a nothing that included everything. You know, it's the whole nothing that had held within it, the whole world. It's a nothing that connected everyone. you can make all kinds of wonderful, inspiring stories about nothing. They're all true, true enough. The nothing that holds everything. There are all these different perspectives that people have, that they sometimes they prefer the perspective that they have, that through which they see this thing which is nothing. And but this nothing that comes from release, from letting go. And as we go down through the layers and the layers, touching what's inside, really becoming quiet and sensitive, listening, hearing, touching, feeling, allowing, we realize with the future that I was holding on to, I was so committed to the future and planning, really, it turns out that's just more flying elephants. I've been holding on to ideas. And the past turns out, you know where the past lives? You know where it's found? It's in exactly the same place as flying elephants. It has exactly the same weight as flying elephants. Your past might be a little bit bigger than a flying elephant. But, you're holding on to, in a certain kind of way, holding on to nothing, to ideas. And memories and our past is certainly can be a wonderful thing. But to cling to it, what about releasing? Or fantasy? Fantasies are kind of flying elephants. Delusions of grandeur. Delusions of how wonderful it's going to be. And fantasies about this and that. I think when I was new to Buddhist practice, doing this practice when I was 20, 21, 22 or so, in meditation, I spent a decent amount of time fantasizing. And I think my fantasies were compensational. I was compensating for my low self-esteem, my sense of guilt, my sense that I was fundamentally wrong, guilty before even doing anything. Anxiety and all kinds of things. And I was kind of compensating for it by having fantasies of grandeur. That I was going to do some wonderful, great thing. And so I was kind of kept being pulled into this world. Just flying elephants. And to be able to be mindful and still enough to see how we are grasping onto ideas and thoughts that really have no substance. They might have some reference points of what's out there, but we're really clinging to the ideas of things, the ideas of what they will do for us, not really the thing themselves. And to feel that, to see, be still enough, quiet enough, sensitive enough, attentive enough to feel and sense, yeah, there's the holding on, there's the clinging, there's the pushing, there's the tightening, contraction, there's the tension. And that's enough just to see it and to hold it in the field of a kind awareness, to hold it with the cupped hands of awareness and just see it. The wonderful thing about this attention, kind awareness, is if you hold your hand in a fist, say someone is really afraid, and so fear is one of the reasons why someone might make a fist, it's because they're just steeling themselves against what's going to come, and they're so afraid that they really can't relax. But then a wonderfully kind, supportive person comes along, and with their warm, soft hand comes underneath and just holds the hand of the person who's this frozen fist, just holds it, gives it support. And the person feels the support. And slowly the hand begins to thaw and relax, slowly opens up. And there's the release. There's the non-clinging. So we can do that for ourselves. We take what we see, our clinging, we see our suffering, and just hold it. The deeper we go in practice, the more the practice becomes more and more just holding the experience and letting things release themselves. And then there's the truth of that release, the truth of that freedom, the truth of that absence of clinging, the truth of that nothing, the not having the fist anymore. And that is a reliable truth. That's a truth which is not a propositional truth. It's not a fantasy. It's not a thought. It's not a very sophisticated understanding about the nature of reality. But it's the absence, the simple absence of clinging and the suffering that comes with that. And that absence, it can be one of the most significant things in a person's life. That absence is freedom. Not necessarily freedom to do something, which in the United States, some people are a little bit neurotic about this whole idea of freedom. Freedom to, certainly freedom to vote is good, and freedom to have assembly, freedom to speak freely, freedom to shop, freedom to fulfill my desires, freedom to get my way, freedom to roll over other people, to ignore them. This idea of freedom too is, you know, can be a little dangerous if we feel like we should be free to do whatever we want. The freedom in Buddhism is a freedom from attachment, from clinging, from tightening up, from craving, from hate, from bias, from prejudice, from fear. And then we get to be bats, kind of, like bats. We get to then discover what our wings are. We discover what flying is for us. But then we don't want to grab onto what we discover. And this is kind of where it gets really fun. It's fun to discover who you are, whatever that might be. It doesn't have to be anything. That's why it's so great. And then we discover what it is. And then grab. That's what it is. I know who I am. And the very time as soon as you really know who you are and you grab onto it, that's probably not who you are anymore. But to be free enough to discover yourself anew every day, to be free enough from all clinging that it's a surprise who you are, a wonderful surprise. You don't have to be anything, just discover it over and over again. So we go through the layers, taking off the clothes, taking off the personas, taking off the masks that we carry with us. And retreats are a wonderful place to do this because there's so little you have to do here. So little you have to accomplish and get done. And it's meant to be a safe place to put down, at least temporarily, so many of the burdens and ways of being and beliefs you have about how you have to be and what you have to accomplish, and just put it down. Put it down. Take off all the gowns and skins that you carry. And if you reach down far enough and touch what's beautiful inside, if you go to the deepest place, you'll find what's most true, which is an absence, which we have to kind of, there's a strong tendency to want to put wonderful, hyperbolic, is that the right word? Hyperbole, adjectives in front of, to make it into something great. Ultimate absence. They've succeeded in Mahayana especially, but also in our tradition, they've succeeded brilliantly in calling it emptiness. Emptiness has much more cachet than absence. But this radical, full, complete absence, that's where we can take our stand. That's where we can then come into the world and meet the world. It can be, that place can be trusted. We can trust that place. And there's a lot of forces that will insist that we can't trust it. But we're supposed to be this way, we're supposed to be that way, have to be this way. So then we're in discussion with ourselves and others about how this works and what's going on here. And part of the resolve, the commitment, I hope, is to stay present. To stay present for this world and the messiness of it, the suffering of it. To take a stand that allows us to be present and here and available. To be in dialogue and be in conversation and be in connection and find out what's really, you know, how we go forward, both as an individual but also as a community. So that it isn't just that the absence, the emptiness holds the whole world, but so our hearts hold the whole world. And that's one of the beautiful things, is that the emptier we become of our clinging, the bigger our hearts become. And if absence, the glorious, ultimate absence, can hold all things within it, then our hearts have also the same capacity to expand outwards and hold all things within it as well. The freedom from clinging is the heart's release. And then, knowing that, even in small degrees, how valuable release is, letting go is, that's the place forward. That's where we find ourselves. That's where there's a path. And once we have enough experience of that, then there can be the resolve on that, the determination. I know what's real. This is really valuable. This is worth basing my life on. No doubts about it. And there can be a life of vow, life of commitment, life of, that's not a limitation, but it's part of this opening, of course. This can be what life is. Of course, this is what I want to do. And if you have some disappointment in what I'm saying today, some protest, but kill. You don't seem to understand. Try to remember Gulu's talk about patience. Just enough so you can wait till tomorrow. And Bruni will talk about the parami of loving kindness. Remember, these build on each other. And perhaps the foundation of truth and resolve is the basis upon a whole different kind of, a whole way of having metta. And hopefully all your doubts will be resolved tomorrow. And it'll all be complete. And if it isn't, more patience. Because then certainly equanimity will do it. So. So one of my hopes in giving this talk is that when we now go back into the practice mode and sitting and walking and all that, that you are somehow inspired to feel, listen, sense into yourself with a quieter, fuller mind tension below all the thoughts and beliefs and stories that you live by. Really listen deeply and see what's down there. If you reach deep down inside you, into the kind of core within, what do you touch? What do you feel? And is there some quality of freedom, of liberation, of non-clinging that has some value for you once you kind of really settle and listen deeply? Here. And is that place a place that might be appropriate to be resolved on, to be committed to stand on? May you find a reliable place to base your life. So let's take a few minutes to sit.